Maine Calling's Your Vote 2020 coverage is brought to you by MEMIC, AARP of Maine, and the law offices of Joe Bornstein.
A Your Vote 2020 conversation with Jared Golden. Jared Golden first won his congressional seat in 2018 by defeating Bruce Poliquin in the second round of the ranked choice voting count. Golden served in the Maine legislature as assistant Democratic floor leader and before that in the Marines in Iraq and Afghanistan. He positions himself as a moderate with independent instincts. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, I am joined by Maine Public senior political correspondent Mal Leary for a Your Vote 2020 interview with Jared Golden, the Democratic incumbent in Maine's 2nd Congressional District. What are your questions for him? Send them by email, tweet, or Facebook. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. This is Maine Calling, and I'm your host, Jennifer Rooks. Co-hosting with me, Maine Public senior political correspondent, Mal Leary. Today on the program, a Your Vote 2020 conversation with Jared Golden, the Democratic incumbent candidate for Maine's 2nd Congressional District seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. And we invite you to submit a comment or question for Representative Golden. You can send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post a comment to our Facebook page. And a programming note, tomorrow morning at 7 a.m., you could tune into this station to hear a Maine Calling with portions of all of our interviews with the congressional candidates. That's tomorrow morning at 7. Jared Golden, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me on, Jennifer. Looking forward to a good hour with you and the listeners.
And Mal Leary, I'm going to have you ask the first question of the congressman.
Congressman, you've often talked of being independent in your positions on a whole range of issues, but yet you voted with Speaker Pelosi 84% of the time. Your opponent says that means you're a liberal and that the folks in the 2nd Congressional District are more conservative. How do you respond to his criticism?
I think you've got to put numbers like that, Mal, in a broader context. When you look at the entire House of Representatives, you know, about 435 members. So there's a few vacant seats, so it's slightly fewer than that. But when you look at the greater body of the House of Representatives in this Congress, and you look at my voting record, I'm in the top 10% of both parties in voting across party aisles, voting against my own party. When you look at the votes that I've taken where I've broken with my caucus, I'm among the top five most likely to do that in the Democratic caucus. Often, I don't think about this as a progressive versus conservative thing now, but rather pragmatism and having a real focus on what can we do to try and lead the House of Representatives towards compromise and trying to get things done. Think about COVID-19 talks where I've really, I think, helped lead in my caucus on trying to force Speaker Pelosi and other leaders to stay at the negotiating table and accept compromise. But in the broader context, I have demonstrated through my voting record that I'm one of the most independent members of Congress, one of the most bipartisan members.
Jared Golden, more than 200,000, closer to 250,000 Mainers rely on Social Security, yet the system is headed for insolvency unless there's a fix. What measures would you support to ensure Social Security's long-term viability?
Well, I think one good thing we could do, Jennifer, is take a look at where we get our revenue for the Social Security program. So, currently, individuals pay into Social Security up to around $132,000 or $137,000. I can't quite remember the exact figure right now. And any income they make annually over that, they don't pay anything into Social Security. That's called the cap. There are proposals out there that would not completely eliminate the cap. It would leave it in place for income between about $130,000 and $400,000, but would ask people who make in excess of $400,000 per year to start making those payments back into Social Security, which is one way that we could bring solvency back to it for a solid 50 to 100 years, depending on the numbers and demographic changes and other things. We could also use that extra revenue to increase the monthly payment, not keeping up with rising costs. And so people who are wholly dependent on Social Security, I think, really struggle with that. Some of the proposals out there that look at lifting that cap, Jennifer, would also say right now, we should do whatever we can to lower taxes for our working middle-class retirees. And so people who have over a certain threshold of income that is non-Social Security related end up having that taxed. And by lifting that cap, we would actually be able to lift the threshold so that they could also bring in more of like their 401k and other things without having it taxed, which would then help them, combine those two things in a more affordable way.
Mal.
Congressman, do you think there needs to be a greater emphasis on some alternatives beyond just Social Security? I know when I've talked with financial planners, they say Social Security is kind of like a base, and you really ought to have, as you mentioned a minute ago, a 401k, individual retirement accounts. Should there be greater tax credits, greater incentives for people to do some savings on their own?
Well, one thing we don't want to do, I don't want to be attacking my opponent. He's not here to have a discussion. But he talks a lot about a plan people are familiar with from after the 2004 election. It was the Bush administration's partial privatization plan, where they wanted to let people take their Social Security or a portion of it and play it in the marketplace. And, that proposal wasn't very popular. The American people rejected it, and they were unable to move forward with it. And the numbers showed that a large portion of Americans would suffer about a 16% reduction. That it would leave people vulnerable. If you're very wealthy, if you have like a good nest egg, you can go maybe play that in the market, but the market can be volatile. We don't want to be playing with Social Security in a way where people can suddenly lose everything. I think that's part of the point of the program, is it provides, like you said, a base and brings in a lot of stability. Obviously, it's not a bad thing to have people out there with 401ks, that they're also getting on top of that. I think looking at things like pensions as well, very important. That I'm a big supporter of the trades unions. One thing I like about unions is they tend to have very strong retirement benefits negotiated with their employer to make sure that they're going to be able to live a good, secure life after putting in the hard work. So absolutely, I think anything the government can do to incentivize businesses to ensure retirement security is a great thing. But bottom line is Social Security is the number one program to make sure our seniors are not living in poverty.
All right. Mal.
In your campaign, you've talked about working with Republicans on legislation, particularly efforts of the so-called Problem Solver Caucus. But so far, those efforts to find a compromise pandemic aid package have failed. Why do you think the impasse continues? Are the Democrats as much to blame for this standoff as the Republicans?
Yeah, I think both sides are to blame at this point, Mal. When I, you step back and you look at what I've been consistently saying, going back to May in voting against the HEROES Act, even though I strongly believe that Congress needs to act to do more, I think I've articulated to you at times what I think it is that Congress needs to do. Absolutely, we need more money for state and local budgets that have taken a hit. I'm actually seeing the White House agreeing with us about that now, offering up to $250 billion. It's not quite where the Democrats are at, but it's getting close. We need to do more assistance for small business owners. We need to continue to help our hospital systems, many of which are taking a real financial hit because of coronavirus. More PPE for our healthcare workers. I mean, the list goes on and on. As you know, you're probably talking about this on the regular, covering it in your reporting. All the American people agree that Congress needs to do more, and yet we've seen these negotiations put on hold, and I believe it's mostly about electoral politics. I think that's unacceptable, and as you know, I've called on leaders of both parties, the Speaker, Senator Mitch McConnell, and the White House to set all the politics aside, focus on doing the job and doing what this country needs to beat coronavirus. I just think there's such a culture out there in our politics right now where people almost look at compromise as weakness. I actually think it's a strength. And when voters deliver us a divided government, it's a necessity if we're going to make any progress and make sure that this country is able to be successful, not only in responding to coronavirus, but so many other great problems that we're facing as a country.
Congressman Golden, I want to turn to foreign policy now. The Economist magazine is reporting today that 880,000 ethnic Uyghur children in China are separated from their parents, the parents in concentration camps, the children placed in boarding houses. China's other provocations include military exercises in the South China Sea and the imposition of new restrictions in Hong Kong. How should the U.S. respond?
Well, as a member of the Armed Services Committee, I have advocated that we have the strongest posture that we can as we look at China as a rising potential threat. We often talk about them and that committee as a near peer competitor. They're making big investments in their military strength. They are getting quite aggressive in the Pacific in their posture and some of the things that they're doing. And, you know, do represent at times a real threat to many of their neighbors and to the kind of global systems that we have in place to ensure fairness in the market. And, you know, obviously we're always going to have to be in a position to advocate for the best interests of the United States. I think that people look at our two economies as very much interconnected. You know, you also never want to, I think, no one wants to see conflict. We should always use diplomacy to try and you know, make sure that our interests are being met in the world. America is in the strongest place that it can. We're in a position we need to take care of our people. But always we got to make an effort to you know, have diplomacy and peace and good relationships with everybody. But I think we have to look to China for the potential threat that it is and continue to make smart investments with our military, continue to use diplomacy to have allies in the region and be a positive force in that region and talking about the merits of democracy, of capitalism, and a you know a global market where countries can work together and everyone can benefit.
Should the U.S., for example, defend Taiwan?
Well, I think that it is currently the position of the United States that we have a very strong relationship with Taiwan, and we support you know the independence of that country.
Mel?
You talk about smart investments in the military. Where do you see where we've been making some investments that are not so smart? Because one of the things that I'm sure you learned when you were in the Marines is a lot of waste in the military.
Well, Mel, I got to disagree. The Marines really prided themselves on operating on a very low budget. We always said we do less with more. I'm sorry, we do more with less. And, you know, sometimes our old gear really showed that we live by that motto. And, you know, you always hear Marine generals in front of the Armed Services Committee advocating for fiscal responsibility and being responsible with taxpayer dollars while making sure that the Marine Corps continues to be the tip of the spear, the president's own, and the first to go. I think that we have to be cognizant of the fact that we should not be the world's policeman. We cannot be all things for everybody, and we can't be everywhere at once. We need to choose our priorities smartly and wisely. We need to lead with diplomacy. That is certainly, I think, the greatest way to avoid unnecessary high-level military spending. You know, you look at what happened in Iraq. I mean, a lot of the funding wasn't even on the actual you know, defense spending appropriations bill. They set it aside, as you know, through what they called the OCO budget. You know, as we're trying to shift to focusing on rising near-peer competitors like China and Russia, continues, I think, to be hard to make that shift, Mal, if we are also still very much engaged in places like Iraq and Afghanistan. And we got to make some tough decisions and smart investments. I personally think the United States Navy needs a strong focus. And it is not necessarily about more ships. China is, I think, very openly building to have a larger Navy than us and our allies. When you talk to Navy admirals and other important military leaders, what they talk about isn't how many ships do we have, but what are the capabilities that they deliver? What's the quality of it? Do we have a better, you know, more high quality, more technologically advanced Navy? That's what we're looking for. If that takes 400 ships or 200 ships, let's not focus on the numbers, but on the investments that we're making. Obviously, that's important to the district, to the state with Bath Ironworks, but really it's about having the military that we need for the future. And when you think about the Pacific now, I think obviously everyone can agree the Navy figures very largely into that planning and military readiness.
Congressman, Maine and the nation are on track to set a record in terms of gun sales this year. The FBI, for example, ran more than 70,000 background checks on new gun purchases in Maine between March and August of this year. Does this concern you? Do you believe gun laws need to be tightened?
Well, you talked about, I think you just said 70,000 background checks conducted. That's why we have the system in place that we have. I think it's important that we make investments in our background check system to make sure that it is seamless, that there's no silos, that information is being shared, and we're not seeing anyone falling through the cracks of an underfunded system or an understaffed, under-resourced system. There have been some instances in recent years where we have seen shootings committed by individuals who were prohibited from owning a firearm, some of whom had actually gone through a background check program that failed to pick up the fact that they shouldn't have been allowed to obtain that firearm. So continue to put more into that system, I think, is a good way to go. You're familiar with the fact that I voted against H.R. 8, which was the universal background check system, very much similar to what voters rejected in Maine in 2016. I think bottom line is we should focus on keeping all firearms out of the hands of criminal, felon individuals who shouldn't be allowed to have any firearms, have shown that they can't be trusted with that right. And it is a constitutionally protected right. And so rather than trying to keep, specific types of firearms out of the hands of law-abiding citizens, let's focus on the individuals that we know have demonstrated that they can't be trusted with that right.
Well, let's follow up on that. The 70,000 FBI background checks are predominantly guns that are bought at gun stores. They don't account for private sales of guns. We don't have any way of knowing because there is no background check system. This is something that you have voted against in the past. What do you believe needs to be in place for gun sales that are not guns that are purchased at stores, standalone stores with federal licenses?
Yeah, I think that the greatest problem that we're seeing out there, Jennifer, is not personal sales and transfers, but rather a black market where there's kind of co-occurring criminal activity that leads to an exchange of firearms for things like illicit drugs. So we need to make smart investments in like the ATF and DEA and our law enforcement and ensure that we're able to crack down on that. When you look at personal transfers, I don't think it's anywhere near proven that that is the source of the transfer of firearms to felons and other prohibited individuals that shouldn't have them. I do think that I've been supportive of things that would heighten penalties for anyone who knowingly, knowingly transfers a firearm to a prohibited individual. We need to send a strong message that you need to be very responsible in deciding who you transfer firearms to.
All right. Well, we are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will continue this Your Vote 2020 conversation with Jared Golden, the incumbent and the Democratic candidate for Maine's 2nd Congressional District. Your questions when we come back. This is Maine Calling.
Your Vote 2020 programming is made possible by your support and by AARP Maine, providing information on voting from home with absentee ballots, aarp.org/Maine Votes. By the law offices of Joe Bornstein, who believe that voting rights are the cornerstone of democracy. Learn more at vote.org/state/Maine. And MEMIC, with a mission to improve workforce safety and injury management and a goal of sending millions back to the Maine economy.
Democrats are gaining momentum in Texas.
These people came back and they're better and have more money. And so we are just seeing this assault all over the state in areas I never dreamed would be competitive.
But can they turn this Republican stronghold blue? Next time on The Takeaways, Politics with Amy Walter from WNYC and PRX.
Tonight at 8 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. This afternoon at 2 o'clock, a rebroadcast of last night's Your Vote 2020 debate among the four candidates for the U.S. Senate. That's today at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio and available anytime for listening or viewing at mainepublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, Jared Golden, Democratic candidate for U.S. House representing the 2nd Congressional District. He's also the incumbent. He joins me in Maine Public's Mal Leary for a conversation about his positions on the issues that matter to you. Share your comments and questions by sending an email, a brief email, please, to talk@mainepublic.org. Post a tweet at Maine Calling or comment on our Facebook page. And please note that we are not taking calls during today's program. We'll start, though, this section by going to a voicemail that came in from a listener before the program.
My name is Mary Ann. I'm calling from Cape Elizabeth. Since he has worked closely with Sarah Gideon and with Susan Collins, I would be interested in knowing who Jared Golden will be voting for in November. Thank you. Bye.
Congressman?
Well, I think the caller identified it correctly. I've worked very closely with Sarah Gideon when she was Speaker of the House. My first 2 years, she was the Assistant Majority Leader. My first job in politics, everyone knows I worked for Senator Susan Collins. Learned a lot from that opportunity. And, even at that time, as a Democrat since I was 18 years old, working in the senator's office was a great opportunity. I learned a lot about what it means to represent the people of Maine, all the people of Maine. So I've been very clear about this. In our delegation, the very small, tight-knit group, when you're thinking about using our power as a group of four for the best interests of the state of Maine, it's not about whether or not you're a Democrat or a Republican. It's not like other states or New York, California, or others. I could go on Michigan. We have one of the smallest federal delegations, and we have to be able to pack, a bigger punch as a group, and that means working together. So when it comes to election activities, you cannot easily work together if you're out there campaigning against one another. I think that's a long kind of tradition of that in the Maine delegation, where we don't see the two senators campaigning against one another or the senators against House members. We stay out of the kind of campaign side of things so that we can stay focused right through the election on working together for the best interests of Maine. And I'm not taking a position in that race.
Mal?
Maineers have seen firsthand the results of the court ruling at Citizens United, where we're having record campaign expenditures in the Senate race. And there's quite a bit of money in your race. But much of it is coming from so-called dark money groups that do not have to reveal their contributors. Are you advocating for disclosure of where that money's coming from? And do we need a constitutional amendment in order to overrule the court's decision?
Citizens United was the worst Supreme Court decision of my life. We have seen an explosion of super PAC spending in the wake of that decision. Just go back and look at the numbers at the outside group spending, whether it be super PACs or, whatever. 501 four groups were hardly even spending politically prior to that decision. And when you look at the data, it jumps off the page. Since Citizens United decision, the explosion of outside money that lacks transparency, we call it dark money, because you don't really know where it's going. There seems to be almost like, I often call it a legal form of money laundering. We have these election laws that are meant to bring transparency or to try and cap the influence of big money, very wealthy individuals, billionaires, and corporations. And yet somehow Congress and with that decision, the Supreme Court have allowed for the opening up of some pretty massive loopholes. Every one of them should be closed as far as I'm concerned. I actually have a bill, Mal, that would take a 501c4 entity and say, if you want to maintain that tax status, if you are a social organization, welfare focused on a specific issue, you must limit your political spending to 10% annually. If you want to spend more than that on campaign, ads, issue ads, then unfortunately you're going to lose that tax exempt status, and you can go ahead and register as a super PAC. We're at the very least people are able to see the FEC reporting on where your money is coming from. This is one of the biggest problems that is causing gridlock in Washington, and I think destroying our democracy. So I'm all for this being a top priority for myself, for my own party, and I hope for Congress, because I think that there's broad support. If you have a television in Maine right now, you know what I'm talking about. There is obviously way too much money in our politics, and we need to find some ways to reduce the influence. I think of billionaires, big corporations, just kind of drowning out the voice of regular, everyday people.
I'm going to go to a tweet from Matt. What is one thing he hoped to see accomplished in his first term that he realized was not possible once he got to Washington? And the follow-up, does he see an opportunity to help make whatever it is a reality this term?
You know, that's a good question. Nothing comes to mind immediately. There was one issue that I really wanted to get done, that was going back to 2014 when I first ran for the State House. I had met with a group of veterans. Some of the veterans at that meeting of my generation raised their concerns that there was no inpatient substance use and mental health care beds at the VA hospital in Togus in Augusta, Maine, and that veterans in need of critical inpatient mental health and substance use counseling had to be on a wait list. They had to go to other states in order to get that care. And I really wanted to do something about that in my first 2 years in Congress. And, April or May, I was starting to get skeptical that we would be successful. We had made some progress in pushing the secretary of the VA, the director of the VHA, and the Boston kind of region office that handles what we have here in Maine to look at this issue. And we thought as a delegation we were making progress. And then they said with coronavirus disrupting their planning and their budgets that they might have to put this off. And so, that was a big disappointment at the time. And I was making plans on if I get reelected, how can we, continue this effort and hopefully deliver. The good news is we found out just about a month ago that we got approved for out-of-cycle funding by the VA, and they're going to move forward next fall with 24 inpatient substance use and mental health care beds for our veterans. So mission accomplished there, but there's a lot of things that we have started that we haven't accomplished that I want to continue working on. On the Small Business Committee, the first thing that comes to mind is I passed legislation out of that committee and through the House of Representatives to reauthorize small business development centers. There's 11 of them in the 2nd District. They offer great kind of a consultant service to small business owners, helping them think through how to either grow their market, how to grow their business, or avoid tough cuts and other things if they're struggling financially. Unfortunately, the Senate has not taken up that work. There seems to be some gridlock between Senator Rubio and Cardin in the Senate Small Business Committee. We're kind of pushing them to try and do, something, get that through in the lame duck session. If they don't, starting that legislation over again in the House Small Business Committee and hopefully getting it through to whoever the president is would be a top priority.
Mm. And speaking of the VA, we do have a voicemail that came in about that. We'll go to that next.
This is Sergeant First Class Robert Shaw from Danville, Maine. I'm a fellow veteran, and I hear story after story about the veterans being denied getting real bad service at the VA center up in Togus. And what have you done to address this issue?
Well, that's a good question. One of the things that I have really taken a lot of pride in, when you're in the State House, you often don't have staff. And so you don't realize, what goes on sometimes in a federal office. Once you get into that position, you have staff who are able to do a lot of great work. We often refer to it as constituent services. And that is one place where an elected official, I think, can have an immediate, very big impact on their constituents' lives in a very positive way, whether it be helping veterans, with the VA, helping seniors who might have been having trouble with Medicare billing, people that have had issues with the IRS, even small businesses. I mean, we set up a task force to help hundreds of businesses when they were closed during coronavirus get connected with the SBA for help, like the Paycheck Protection Programs. But I've told my staff, we got to make this a top priority. When veterans are having issues, we want them to think to call our office to ask for help. I've actually kept people on staff. Kim Roan, who's up in Aroostook County, had worked for Bruce Poliquin before staying on to work for my office. We kept her because we knew how good she was at doing the veterans constituent services. You know, years of knowledge and experience right there, and she's so dedicated to helping our veterans. And all my staff are. My goal is that we're so good at this that if there's a veteran in the 1st Congressional District wants help, they're going to call us. You know, nothing against Congresswoman Pingree. Her staff do great work too, but that's just how big a priority this is for me. We've had veterans come to us with all, an array of assortment of problems with the VA, and we'd stay committed for as long as it takes to trying to get to yes and resolving those problems, making sure our veterans get the best care. Just very quickly, I'll say we had one individual who was denied health coverage, cancer related to their military service exposures, and we were able to, through many months of advocacy, get that covered. What a huge financial burden lifted off the shoulders of that individual and his family in making sure that he's getting the care that he earned when he served the country.
Mal.
Congress has provided literally billions of dollars for personal protective devices for doctors, nurses, other medical care providers, yet supplies are still short. And there are places in the 2nd District where folks are having to reuse masks and gowns, even though that reduces their effectiveness. What steps are you advocating to end these shortages?
Well, we've seen right here in the 2nd District now that the administration has used the Defense Production Act to try and use the levers of government to incentivize companies to start making some of these important equipment materials or other things like swabs, which we're seeing at Puritan. And what great work. I was actually very pleased that the president pointed out the work that was being done there by the workers in Piscataquis County, contributing to the effort. But we can use government to try and encourage the manufacturing of these important medical protective equipment, ventilators and other things right here in the United States. And I think that everyone is committed to that, and we should stay focused on it going forward into the future. It's part of why I think Congress needs to step up, stay at the negotiating table, and put more money towards the coronavirus response. I often talk about how a top priority should be in the healthcare space. And when I say that, I hope people understand that also means an investment in our healthcare systems, in our hospitals, in our frontline workers, to make sure that they have all the equipment they need to protect themselves, but also to care for us.
I want to move on to another Facebook post that came in. This is from Catherine. She writes, "My question is about health care. The current Democratic Party platform expands and builds on the Affordable Care Act, but the Supreme Court is set to hear questions about the ACA on November 10th. If the Supreme Court decides the ACA is unconstitutional in 2021, what will be the next move?"
Well, I think that the most important thing is I'm hoping that they don't do that. And I also think it could be much more complicated than a black or white. The ACA is either constitutional or not. They could choose to strike down certain portions of the law. They actually did that the last time the Supreme Court had the ACA in front of it, saying that it could not mandate that all states expand Medicaid. States had to opt into that, which Maine ultimately did do by voter referendum. So we got to wait and see. There's been, I think, since the very beginning with the rollout of the Affordable Care Act, an effort by many who opposed it to begin with, to find ways to make its implementation more difficult and make it so that it really has not been able to function the way that it was supposed to help drive down costs but ensure access to affordable health care for all Americans. A lot of things that need to be done to make it more efficient or to protect it is to go back, I think, and repair some of the damage that's been done to it. You know, there's been some broken promises by Congress when they originally passed that law. States or other entities haven't always received all of the subsidies or other investments that were promised, and it's caused, I think, some disruptions in how it the market rolls out plays out regionally when it comes to the Affordable Care Act.
We are going to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your questions and comments for Jared Golden. We'll be right back.
Your Vote 2020 programming is made possible by your support and by MEMIC, with a mission to improve workforce safety and injury management and a goal of sending millions back to the Maine economy. By AARP Maine, providing information on voting from home with absentee ballots, aarp.org/MaineVotes. And the law offices of Joe Bornstein, Maine lawyers committed to working for Maine people since 1974. Learn more at joebornstein.com.
On October 16, 2012, a magnitude 4.0 earthquake shook much of Maine. The quake was originally reported to be centered 3 miles west of Hollis Center and 13 miles northwest of Biddeford, but by the following day, the report was adjusted to place the epicenter right in Waterboro. The earthquake was widely felt across central and southern New England from Bangor to Hartford, Connecticut, with scattered reports as far as northern New Jersey and central New York State. According to the United States Geological Survey, the largest earthquake to date in Maine was measured over 5.0 and struck in March 1904. It was felt from the Canadian Maritime Provinces to Connecticut.
On This Day in Maine's History was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Roosevelt Campobello International Park and the Island Institute. Happy birthday, Maine!
I'm Tanya Mosley. Roller skating is having a moment again. Demand for skates is so high, it's even hard to find a pair. And for Jasmine Moore, skating is not only fun, it's a way to advance social justice.
We only see Black pain and Black struggle and, you know, Black hurt. And I want people to see that, look at my happiness, look at my joy.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Coming up shortly after Maine Calling at 12 noon on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling, and Maine Public's Mal Leary joins me in hosting today's program. Today, a Your Vote 2020 conversation with Jared Golden, the incumbent Democratic candidate for the U.S. House seat representing Maine's 2nd Congressional District. We invite you to send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post a comment on our Facebook page. A reminder, we are not taking live calls during this program. Mal.
Congressman, as we mentioned earlier in the program, you served in the Marines. What did you learn about leadership that you apply to your responsibilities as a member of Congress?
Well, I think it informs my idea of what public service is all about, Mal. I often used to tell people that out in the field in the Marine Corps Infantry Unit, if they bring hot chow out, which doesn't happen very often, we had a very simple rule that we would line up in order of rank, that is from lowest rank, the private, to the highest ranking individual who is out there in the field with that unit. And it's supposed to show leaders that they got to put the people that they lead first, that it's not about them. It's about the team and about accomplishing the mission. I take that lesson right there, and I bring it into how I view this job as a member of Congress. I just said to my constituents last night in my closing remarks, a debate we had, WABI. Look, I know what this job is about. I know what service is about. It's not about me. It's about my constituents, and it's about the country. That's how I approach every issue, and making sure that I'm thinking about the people that I'm serving, that I'm representing, and thinking about the best interests of the country.
I'm sorry, we'll go to a voicemail that came in before the program.
Hi, this is Matt from Unity. I'd like to know what the candidate thinks about publicly funded abortions. We understand that people are decidedly pro-life, pro-choice, but either way, it seems as though publicly funding abortions is sort of immoral, either way, even if you are pro-choice. Thanks.
Yeah, I'm openly pro-choice, 100% pro-choice. This is something that Dale has communicated about. He's very strongly pro-life. I think this is a healthcare decision between a woman and her healthcare provider. Certainly programs out there like Maine Family Planning, Planned Parenthood, very important to access to important healthcare for women. And that's just kind of the way that I view it right there. I've expressed concerns at times about some of the positions that Dale has. I'm very respectful of people's views on this, but I do think, sometimes when we start thinking about things like victims of sexual assault, we also have to keep in mind the importance of women having access to choice and to health care.
All right. And Matt's question was specifically about government funding. Right now with the Hyde Amendment, I don't believe there is any government funding for abortion services. Would you support a change there?
We'd have to look more into that proposal, I guess. That's not something that we've seen come up before us in the last 2 years.
An email here from Kyle. Would you support legislation calling for running background checks on law enforcement officers for affiliation with white supremacist groups and ideology? Would this be an effective means to supply insight into the systemic nature of racism within our justice system?
I am quite confident in the Maine criminal justice system and the screening process they have with our law enforcement officers here in Maine to make sure that we're hiring individuals of the utmost character. And desire to serve our communities, to protect and serve is what it's all about. And I think that the vast majority of law enforcement officers believe that, and that's why they do the job. I don't think it's necessary to conduct that kind of a screening absent any kind of data or evidence that there is some kind of cultural problem within the ranks of a department. So at this time, I would say no.
Mal.
What about psychological testing? I mean, a lot of police departments do that now and screen out potential candidates for their force based on those tests.
As someone that served in the Marine Corps Infantry and fought overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan, I think checking in on the mental health and well-being of your force and the individuals that comprise that force is really important. The military has come a long way in thinking about things like post-traumatic stress. Thinking about it as a natural kind of work place, if you want to call combat that, exposure. It's a high-risk job, and trying to establish resiliency by investing in our men and women in uniform is a great way to address that and keep them able to do the job that they want to do, which is protect their communities. It's no different with our law enforcement officers. Now, I've worked in the state legislature to try and make sure that our first responders, EMTs, police officers, firefighters who see a lot of tough things, they're there when things are the worst for a lot of families. They see a lot of tragedy. They carry that home with them. They set it aside so that they can do the job and they get up and do it again the next day. Sometimes that adds up. It is a workplace exposure, and we do see people who it's going to wear them down and they need a little bit of help. We want to destigmatize that and encourage them to come forward. So I've passed actual laws to do that. I was just at a press conference the other day with NAMI Maine and several police officers in the state of Maine talking about things like community-oriented policing services grants that I have voted for that are now bringing resources home to Maine to set up peer-to-peer counseling resources for law enforcement officers. People like Senator Shenna Bellows, who has worked to ensure that law enforcement officers have the ability to access that peer-to-peer counseling or other forms of counseling, with privacy, so that they're not concerned that it may have some kind of negative impact on them in the workplace. Often people are very concerned about stigma, which we should be doing away with that stigmatization of mental health and really viewing it as a resiliency program.
An email here from Memorie. My prescription drug prices are out of control, and it's gotten worse in the last 2 years. What have you done, if anything, to try and lower costs?
I voted for H.R. 3. I think that's one of the biggest opportunities specific legislation that's being talked about right now to try and do something about prescription costs, prescription medication costs, which are spiraling out of control. I've heard about this repeatedly from my constituents, especially AARP and seniors in my district have been coming to our office asking us, well, what can we do? HR 3 would cap out-of-pocket costs for seniors under the Medicare program for their prescription meds at $2,000 annually. It would also direct the government to use the purchasing power of our Medicare, Medicaid, taxpayer resources to negotiate and drive the hardest bargain with pharmaceutical manufacturers to bring those costs down for the 200 most expensive medicines that are used under those government healthcare programs. And so having accomplished that, we would then make those lower prices available to people who are carrying private insurance. So I think that's one smart thing we could do. The VA negotiates for the lowest prices for prescription medications that they provide to our veterans. And that's one of the parts of the VA healthcare system that veterans like most. Often you'll hear veterans say, well, I'm going to the VA because the prescription med prices and the cost shares are very low. It's a great, great benefit.
All right. And an email from Anna. How will you address climate change while in Congress? What do you have to say to climate change deniers?
Well, I think climate change is very real and of great concern. We have warming, fastest warming body of water in the world. It's the Gulf of Maine. It's a threat to our lobster fishery and a lot of coastal communities, rising sea levels, something that the Pentagon has rightfully identified as a national security threat. As I travel around the state, I talk to farmers who, go on at great length about new pests and insects, diseases showing up, coming after Maine crops, things that we had never seen this far north are now starting to emerge with rising temperatures in the world. So I really think government has to play a role in helping with investments in the research, development, and commercialization of renewable energy. So when we look at the University of Maine, we've driven a lot of federal funding to that university. They're working on the potential for offshore wind in Maine. I was just up in Eastport, Maine, where there's a private company, again, getting some federal monies, working with the university on tidal power, a lot of tidal power generation capabilities off the coast of Maine as well. We got to look at the resources that we have. How can we capture some renewable energy opportunities, not only to get off of fossil fuels here in Maine and have a resilient local power grid, but hopefully use those resources to create some jobs in that sector as well, which would be really great for the economy. I just think that's the best role for government. Actually, I was very disappointed last year. At the end of the year, Congress was negotiating certain tax credits out there, like healthcare tax credits, workforce development tax credits, and we couldn't get agreement with the Senate Republicans. Senator Mitch McConnell didn't want to support tax credits to incentivize investments in renewable energy like solar and wind and tidal power. And I think that's was a very unfortunate a failure of the Congress in last year, and something I hope we'll be able to get a deal on in the lame duck this year.
Mal?
The nation's intelligence agencies have been reporting Russia, China, Iran, and other countries are trying to influence the outcome of the elections here in the United States. Should we retaliate against those nations? And if so, how?
To be completely honest with you, Mal, as a member of the Armed Services Committee, I will say I get briefed on this. I'm briefed on what the United States government is doing about it, steps that we are taking to protect this country, protect our critical infrastructure, which includes our elections. Actually, the most critical infrastructure, our election system, and protecting our democracy from foreign influence. Believe me, the government is acting, and that may include a mixture of defensive or offensive type activities. Security clearance issues would basically ensure that I can't go into great depth about that right now.
Let's wrap with a question from Tom on Facebook. Please ask Mr. Golden for three examples of his bipartisan votes, maybe including those where he did not vote with the Speaker of the House.
Sure. One that comes to mind is an effort by the speaker on a lot of members of my caucus who are from more urban areas, New York, California, to do away with a part of the 2017 tax code. It's called the SALT tax, state and local tax, where they made a change in law, the Republicans did, that said you couldn't write off your state and local taxes when you're filing your federal taxes. The Democrats in the House have made repealing that change a top priority. I have opposed it because, I think it would, first of all, not have a great impact on the people that I represent. And it would take away potential important resources that is available to the government to spend on other important priorities. As I think about things like our healthcare system, investing in roads and bridges, our infrastructure, whatever it may be, eliminating that SALT tax change would cost tens of billions of dollars. And I didn't see that it was in the best interest of my community, so I didn't support it. I guess I'll talk about the USMCA trade deal. Actually, something leaders in both parties supported, I didn't vote for. I think NAFTA was not a good trade deal for the United States. It was not good for the 2nd Congressional District. Very bad on manufacturing. We've seen all those jobs outsourcing. And when I look at the USMCA trade deal, I see what I call NAFTA 2.0. It's barely any different than what we had before. All this big talk about how it has totally changed NAFTA, which was harmful in many ways to Maine. And I don't think that they really changed much at all in a very positive way for the 2nd District. I expect to see more outsourcing of jobs to Mexico, more outsourcing of jobs to Mexico where there's lax worker standards, environmental standards, and other things. I think that trade deal was great for Silicon Valley, for Amazon, and a lot of others.
Mm. Well, Jared Golden, we're going to have to have you stop at two examples because we're out of time. And thank you so much for joining us today. Jared Golden, the Democratic candidate for U.S. Representative for Maine's 2nd Congressional District. And of course, Mal, thank you for joining us for the last 2 weeks for the Your Vote 2020 candidate interviews. This concludes our series of those. Be sure to tune in for the Your Vote 2020 debates next week, Tuesday and Thursday at 8. Mal and I, along with Steve Missler, will moderate two congressional debates with the four candidates live on Maine Public Radio, television, and streaming at mainepublic.org. Of course, Congressman Jared Golden will be part of one of those. Today's sound engineer, Lucy Suchek. This program will be rebroadcast tonight at 7. You can also sign up for our podcast at mainecalling.org. Our theme music, written by Mike Gendreau. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.